Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our program is designed especially for people learning English. Today on the show, Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher, and we close with an American story. But first, Min is a teacher in Myanmar. As a girl, she had great respect for Aung San Suu Kyi, the former opposition leader who now leads the country. But when Myanmar holds elections on Sunday, Nin will not vote for her. This will be the second general election since the end of military rule in 2015. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy is expected to win again on the strength of its leader's strong popularity. Nin, however, says the Nobel Peace Prize winner failed to keep her promise to unite the country, also known as Burma. "I have no more trust in her," said the young woman. She added, "The path she is trying to take towards democracy is impossible." Aung San Suu Kyi's party won by a very large victory in 2015. Myanmar in 2020, however, is facing problems that she does not seem able to solve. In addition to the coronavirus health crisis, there is rising economic hardship and growing ethnic and civil conflicts. Nin is one of many activists from a student group responsible for anti-government protests and leaflet campaigns across the country in recent months. The All Burma Federation of Students Union is calling for a boycott of the general election. Its campaign has been met with a sharp crackdown. 9 of the group's members have been sentenced to prison, 2 of them to 5 years. They were jailed for public mischief, among other charges. 10 other members are in police detention, and at least 12 more are in hiding. Representatives of the NLD and the government did not answer requests for comment from Reuters News Agency. Aung San Suu Kyi's defenders say the students are not being realistic. Change cannot happen quickly after 50 years of military rule, they say. The All Burma Federation of Students Union began a No More War campaign in March. The students put up signs and gave out leaflets condemning the war in Rakhine State. Rakhine borders Bangladesh. In 2017, Myanmar's military began attacking villages in Rakhine, killing and raping ethnic Rohingya who lived there, and burning their homes. More than 730,000 Rohingyas were forced to flee to Bangladesh. The United Nations condemned Myanmar's military action as genocidal. Myanmar denies the accusation. It says it acted rightfully to end a rebellion. Now in Rakhine, there is another conflict between government troops and the Arakan Army. The Arakan Army is an armed group fighting for greater self-rule for Rakhine State. The army has denied targeting civilians in the latest conflict. Many people have been killed and tens of thousands displaced in the fighting. The Myanmar government says the Arakan Army is a terrorist organization. In cities and towns across the country, the students have given out leaflets that say, "Dictatorships must fail." They also urge the government to lift restrictions on the internet in Rakhine. Nin said she sympathized with victims of the war because she grew up in an area also affected by conflict. The government did nothing to stop the conflict and was a puppet of the army, she said. She blames the 2008 Constitution, written by the military, that gives the army major powers. Maya Tudor teaches at the Blavnik School of Government at Oxford University in Britain. She studies countries moving toward democracy. Tudor said the NLD had failed to make democratic changes, choosing instead to increase controls on the media and arrest critics. Government ministers have said people's expectations for the NLD's first years in office were unrealistically high. They also said the government had removed some of the worst laws from the days of military rule and planned additional reforms. Ethnic-based parties are expected to pull some votes away from the NLD in the election on Sunday. Voting has been canceled in more than 50 areas because of unrest. Richard Horsey is an expert on Myanmar with the International Crisis Group. He said ethnic minorities no longer see Aung San Suu Kyi as their natural leader, as they did in 2015. Instead, they now see her as their enemy. This could drive more armed conflict, he said.
With temperatures dropping across the United States, drive-in theaters do not have much time left. Still, many drive-ins, or places where people watch movies in their cars, are staying open beyond their usual closing date for the season. The Northfield Drive-In, near Hinsdale, New Hampshire, went 2 months past its closing date. The drive-in has played an important part in the community. Along with movies, it has held graduation ceremonies for everyone from young students to doctors of medicine. Northfield held its final event last weekend. Visitor Julia Wiggins called the drive-in a major community service project. Hundreds of miles away, Jay Mowry operates the Cumberland Drive-In in Newville, Pennsylvania. Mowry has held a wedding there, a trick-or-treating event, and other activities. He also closed the drive-in for the season last weekend. But, like other drive-in owners, he expects to continue socially distanced events when he reopens in the spring. It's been a lot better than being closed, and it's certainly helped the community. It's given them a place to gather, says Mowry. John Vincent is president of the United Drive-In Theater Owners Association. Vincent estimates more than 200 drive-ins were still operating through last weekend. Showing movies is only part of what these drive-ins do, especially since Hollywood film companies stopped releasing their big films. Marcella Snyder runs the Tibbs Drive-In in the Midwestern city of Indianapolis, Indiana. Snyder usually holds one or two private events a year. This year, she held 50. And, she says, the requests are still coming for November and December. If it starts snowing, what am I going to do? Asked Snyder. Like indoor theaters, drive-ins are limiting visitor numbers by about half to make safe social distancing possible. This fall, most drive-ins are seeing much higher attendance than normal. Drive-ins like Tibbs now use online ticketing and food ordering. We built our whole business on nostalgia, and it's nice that we've turned a corner. We've kind of brought it into the 21st century, says Snyder. Some American drive-ins have even more to offer. Just outside the city of Detroit, Michigan, is the Ford, Wyoming drive-in. It has 5 large screens and is open all night, from sundown to sunrise. The Ford, Wyoming does not have a season. Its operator also owns a building company, so the drive-in has snow-clearing equipment available nearby. The drive-in is open year-round. Co-owner William Clark admits the Ford, Wyoming is unusual for drive-ins. He says ticket sales this October were about 2 times higher than usual. We never close, he says, unless there's a 10-inch snowstorm right before the movie goes on the screen. I'm John Russell.
Today we answer a question from Sohaila in Iran. She writes, what's the difference between job, occupation, career, and profession? Dear Sohaila, thank you for asking this question. The 4 words you named have small differences. I will start with job, the simplest of the words. A job is work people do usually for money. It can mean work a person does for a single employer. That work might last for years or a much shorter period, as in this example. The shortest job I have ever had lasted 3 weeks. We may also use the word job to talk about unpaid work, as in housework. Mother said, cleaning your room is your most important job today. The word occupation is more general and means the kind of work a person does. For example, I left my previous occupation to be a professional artist. We also use occupation to talk about things people enjoy spending a lot of time doing, as in this example. Hai's favorite occupation is playing tennis. But note that this use of the word has become less common over time. A career is what people do over a longer period of time. We use the word career to talk about a series of jobs over a person's lifetime. Some people plan a career, while others simply try for better jobs. You can also use career to talk about what someone does in school, the military, or performing arts. General George Patton had many victories in his military career. A career depends on your goals and the path you want to take through your working life. It does not always require that you have special training. However, a profession is a kind of occupation that requires special training, knowledge, or skills. For some occupations, you must successfully complete a study program at a college or university. Or you must pass a test and practice in your field of expertise for some time before you can become a professional. Here are two examples. Magazines can be about any profession, like medicine, law, engineering, teaching, and so on. I have spent years learning my profession, and I will not quit easily. Finally, let us compare all four words in Sohaila's question. A job is work you do sometimes for pay. An occupation is something you spend your time on. A career is the path you follow through your working life. A profession is a career that requires special knowledge or skills. I hope this helps to answer the question. And that's Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
Our story today is called The Open Boat. It was written by Stephen Crane and is based on what really happened to him in 1896. Crane was traveling from the United States to Cuba as a newspaper reporter. One night, his ship hit a sandbar. It sank in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida. Most of the people on board got into lifeboats. Crane was among the last to leave. There were three others with him, the ship's captain, the cook, and a sailor. These four men climbed into the only remaining lifeboat. Here is Shep O'Neill with the first part of the story.
The small lifeboat bounced from wave to wave in the rough seas of the Atlantic. The four men in the boat could not see the sky. The waves rose too high. The waves, with their white tops, pushed at the open boat with angry violence. Every man thought each wave would be his last. Surely the boat would sink, and he would drown. The man thought that most adults would need a bathtub larger than the boat they were sailing. The waves were huge, and each created a problem in guiding the direction of the boat. For 2 days since the ship sank, the four men had been struggling to reach land. But there was no land to be seen. All the men saw were violent waves, which rose and came fiercely down on them. The men sat in the boat, wondering if there was any hope for them. The ship's cook sat in the bottom of the boat. He kept looking at the 15 centimeters which separated him from the ocean. The boat had only 2 wooden oars. They were so thin, it seemed as if they would break against the waves. The sailor, named Billy, directed the boat's movement with 1 of the oars. The newspaper reporter pulled the 2nd oar. He wondered why he was there in the boat. The 4th man was the captain of the ship that had sunk. He lay in the front of the small boat. His arm and leg were hurt when the ship sank. The captain's face was sad. He had lost his ship and many of his sailors. But he looked carefully ahead, and he told Billy when to turn the boat. "Keep her a little more south, Billy," he said. "A little more south, sir," the sailor repeated. Sitting in the boat was like sitting on a wild horse. As each wave came, the boat rose and fell, like a horse starting toward a fence too high to jump. The problem was that after successfully floating over one wave, you find that there is another one behind it, just as strong and ready to flood your boat. As each wall of water came in, it hid everything else that the man could see. The waves came in silence. Only their white tops made threatening noises. In the weak light, the faces of the men must have looked gray. Their eyes must have shone in strange ways as they looked out at the sea. The sun rose slowly into the sky. The men knew it was the middle of the day because the color of the sea changed from slate gray to emerald green with gold lights, and the white foam on the waves looked like falling snow. As the lifeboat bounced from the top of each wave, the wind tore through the hair of the men. As the boat dropped down again, the water fell just past them. The top of each wave was a hill from which the men could see, for a brief period, a wide area of shining sea. The cook said the men were lucky because the wind was blowing toward the shore. If it started blowing the other way, they would never reach land. The reporter and the sailor agreed, but the captain laughed in a way that expressed humor and tragedy all in one. He asked, "Do you think we've got much of a chance now, boys?" This made the others stop talking. To express any hope at this time, they felt to be childish and stupid. But they also did not want to suggest there was no hope, so they were silent. "Oh, well," said the captain, "we'll get ashore all right." But there was something in his voice that made them think, as the sailor said, "Yes, if this wind holds." Seagulls flew near and far. Sometimes the birds sat down on the sea in groups near brown seaweed that rolled on the waves. The anger of the sea was no more to them than it was to a group of chickens 1,000 miles away on land. Often the seagulls came very close and stared at the men with black bead-like eyes. The man shouted angrily at them, telling them to be gone. The sailor and the reporter kept rowing with the thin wooden oars. Sometimes they sat together, each using an oar. Sometimes one would pull on both oars while the other rested. Brown pieces of seaweed appeared from time to time. They were like islands, bits of earth that did not move. They showed the men in the boat that it was slowly making progress toward land. Hours passed. Then, as the boat was carried to the top of a great wave, the captain looked across the water. He said that he saw the lighthouse at Mosquito Inlet. The cook also said he saw it. The reporter searched the western sky. "See it?" said the captain. "No," said the reporter slowly. "I don't see anything." "Look again," said the captain. He pointed. "It's exactly in that direction." This time, the reporter saw a small thing on the edge of the moving horizon. It was exactly like the point of a pin. "Think we'll make it, Captain?" he asked. "If this wind holds and the boat doesn't flood, we can't do much else," said the captain. It would be difficult to describe the brotherhood of men that was here established on the sea. Each man felt it warmed him. They were a captain, a sailor, a cook, and a reporter. And they were friends. The reporter knew even at the time that this friendship was the best experience of his life. All obeyed the captain. He was a good leader. He always spoke in a low voice and calmly. "I wish we had a sail," he said, "to give you two boys a chance to rest." So they used his coat and one of the oars to make a sail, and the boat moved much more quickly. The lighthouse had been slowly growing larger. At last, from the top of each wave, the men in the boat could see land. Slowly, the land seemed to rise from the sea. Soon, the men could see two lines, one black and one white. They knew that the black line was formed by trees, and the white line was the sand. At last, the captain saw a house on the shore, and the lighthouse became even larger. "The keeper of the lighthouse should be able to see us now," said the captain. "He'll notify the life-saving people." Slowly and beautifully, the land rose from the sea. The wind came again. Finally, the men heard a new sound. The sound of waves breaking and crashing on the shore. "We'll never be able to make the lighthouse now," said the captain. "Swing her head a little more north, Billy."
"A little more north, sir,"
said the sailor. The men watched the shore grow larger. They became hopeful. In an hour, perhaps, they would be on land. The men struggled to keep the boat from turning over. They were used to balancing in the boat. Now they rode this wild horse of a boat like circus men. The water poured over them. The reporter thought he was now wet to the skin, but he felt in the top pocket of his coat and found 8 cigars. 4 were wet, but 4 were still dry. One of the men found some dry matches. Each man lit a cigar. The 4 men sailed in their boat with the belief of a rescue shining in their eyes. They smoked their big cigars and took a drink of water.
And that is our show for today. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.